Institute for the rest of this calendar year, and I'd like to welcome you all here to the Institute this evening. First, as usual for the regular attenders, you'll recognize this next spiel. I'd like to encourage anyone who's not a member of the Vancouver Institute to become one. We've still got 8 very interesting talks for the rest of this series before Christmas. So the membership, which is $10 for students and $20 for an individual and $30 for a family, is a real bargain. It's even cheaper than renting a video, and it's a lot more informative. So if you're able to, please do join on your way out. This year, we've got an inducement to encourage those people who may think of giving us a donation. If someone is kind enough to give us at least $75, then they get a free copy of a new book, which should be out within the next 2 weeks, called The Vancouver Institute, An Experiment in Public Education. Now, it has in it a history of the Institute, and it's about 700 pages long, because it also contains the text of 29 lectures that have been given here in the last 3 years. So I hope, if anybody's so inclined, that'll be an inducement. Our speaker tonight is Jim Hudson. Professor Hudson received his BSc and his MSc at the University of London in chemistry and biochemistry before he emigrated to Alberta. His PhD then at the University of Alberta was in the field of the molecular biology of bacterial viruses. And then he went on to come to UBC and join the faculty here. That's 30 years ago. And in the decades since, he's done research on the viruses of a wide range of species, bacteria, insects, fish, birds, and mammals, including people. And during his career, because of his reputation, he's been invited to work for various periods in many parts of the world, including Switzerland, Australia, Britain, and Africa, to study viruses. Now, his interests in the last 10 years have shifted a little bit, still on a related topic, but he's now looking at the antiviral properties of plants and how these are of use in medicines. So I'd like to welcome Professor Hudson, whose topic tonight is the evaluation of Mother Nature's antivirals. Traditional medicine meets modern science. Professor Hudson.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction. If you have any trouble listening to me with this contraption on from the back, please let me know, please indicate, and we'll try and get something done about it. Otherwise, I'll continue talking roughly at this level of voice for the rest of the evening. Some of you may be wondering why I, as a molecular biologist, would be interested in the subject of medicinal plants. Well, the fact is, there's a desperate need to get some science into this field. I'm sure many of you realize that. I myself frequently go to our local health food store, get herbal medicines and multivitamins and so forth. And very often I pick up one of these glossy magazines, that you know, health food magazines, which talks about all these wonderful things that you can take to cure all ills and so forth. And now there's probably a lot of truth in there somewhere behind all those claims. But the trouble is, I often have to shake my head on reading some of the articles, and especially the advertisements, because it's very clear that people don't really know how to explain how these things work. But there's a lot of pseudo-scientific information there. And it's time for scientists to get in there, members of the scientific research community and the medical profession, to get in there and start taking a serious look at all these things and try to explain how they work properly. The other reason, or two other reasons actually, why it's important for people like myself to get into this field. During conversations in recent years with traditional healers from a number of countries in Africa and Asia, for example, I have been told by these people over and over again that they welcome Western-trained scientists getting into this field because they want people like us to study their materials and to authenticate them, so they can then go back to their potential clients, their patients, and say, look, you know, my materials, which you've been criticizing in recent years, have been shown to work by Western-trained scientists, so there must be something in them. And another reason, too, is the whole issue of quality control. There's got to be some quality control in herbal medicines, because otherwise the profession is always going to be daunted by this specter of occasional adulterated and fake materials and people making false claims. There's got to be quality control. And in order to do that, you've got to understand how these things are working and what the principal active ingredients are. So that summarizes why I got into this field in the first place. Now I'll start with my slides. If I can, first one. And I hope that's okay as far as visualizing the slides is concerned. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to be wandering around a little bit while I talk about these different slides that I show on the screen. I will have about 30-odd slides to show. Some of them contain pretty pictures of flowers, which will interest some of you. A few of them will have some chemical structures on them. Not too many, I promise, but just in case somebody's interested in that sort of thing. I know some members of the audience will be. And the others will be explanatory and philosophical type slides to explain the things that I'm talking about. After my introductory remarks, then I will talk about three specific examples to illustrate the way we go about doing our studies and the kind of things we have found out. I will then follow that up with an attempt at synthesizing something from all of these results, and also getting into the slightly more speculative but more interesting area of trying to explain alternative mechanisms as to how these things work. Now, first of all, just to briefly put you in the background, I've got to say a few words about viruses themselves. The reason I work with antivirals, or the reason I'm looking for antivirals, is partly because I'm a virologist, and that's my specialty, of course. And also, it turns out that in the traditional medicinal plant world, a lot of people take things to counteract infectious diseases, many of which include viruses, of course. And although the traditional medicine doesn't include provision for looking for antivirals, because viruses are a fairly recent discovery in terms of traditional medicine, but what generally goes on in the traditional medicine field is that people take these things to treat a set of symptoms. It's not like in the Western scientific or medical system where people take things for the purpose of eradicating an agent of disease, that sort of thing. In the more traditional systems, people treat symptoms. And whether they are caused by a virus or a bacterium or a parasite doesn't really matter. It's the symptoms that count, and that's what they're trying to get rid of. And that's how their system is based. What we're trying to do is to see whether we can explain some of these things in terms of discrete antiviral and antibacterial compounds and so forth. Now, I would just like to remind you of a few things about viruses before I go here. I think the statements there are fairly obvious. I just want to draw your attention, though, to the number three. Remember, viruses are fast-replicating organisms, and because they replicate very fast, they also mutate frequently. And that's an important point to bear in mind, because if they mutate, then it means they're going to become resistant to a lot of drugs and chemicals which are poured into the body to try and counteract these things. Number four there, viruses frequently persist after the acute stage of infection. It's often been thought and has often been said in textbooks in the past that once the body has controlled a virus infection, or once you've taken a suitable agent to control the virus, that that's the end of the story. In fact, that's not the case. Viruses frequently persist, and they may subsequently be reactivated and cause more disease. So we've always got to be on the lookout for that taking place. And number five on that slide there, I'll be returning to that theme several times during the course of the presentation, because I think that one of the secrets to the benefits of some of these medicinal plants is not so much their direct activities against specific agents of disease, but the fact that they can augment host defenses, because virus infections are normally controlled by our host defenses. So if we can find a way of helping those host defenses, then it sometimes is very beneficial. Now, this again is a fairly self-explanatory slide. I don't need to go through this in detail. As most of you realize, that the majority of people living in the world do not take expensive drugs to counteract bacteria and fungal infections, viruses, and so forth. And this is a summary of the reasons why that is so. I don't think anybody would argue against most of these claims here. I would just want to draw your attention to number 4 on that list, though, because this represents the kind of Western scientific attitude towards controlling disease. This concept of sort of magic bullets. You know, the idea is you specifically arrange for a drug, a chemical of some kind, which is going to eradicate or neutralize a specific agent or disease, in other words, a particular virus, and which sounds very good. Unfortunately, in most cases, when we come down with infections, we don't know what the specific agent is, and so we really don't know what kind of chemical we should be taking. And so my statement there is that I think personally that the synthetic drug approach to antivirals and antibiotics is often too specific. So if that is the case, then what do most people in the world do as alternatives to this? Well, they use what we call traditional medicines. Sometimes the medical profession here refers to them as alternative medicines, but in fact to them they're traditional medicines, they're the normal situations. And it takes many forms in which you can carry out these traditional medical practices. If you want, you can go to, this is a scene in Togo in West Africa, for example, in the marketplace. This is the herbal section of the marketplace in Lomé, the capital city of Togo. And this woman here is buying some herbal materials. She may be doing that. She's obviously got some bark of a plant in her left hand there. See if I can work this thing. She's holding a piece of bark, which she's probably bargaining over the price about. And she may be a mother picking up some stuff to use for a childhood infection. She may, in fact, be a healer herself. I don't know. I didn't get around to asking her. But she obviously knows what she's looking for. She went to the herbal part of the market to pick up specific materials, and she's going to use them. So you can do things that way. Many people in many parts of the world gather plants or go to the local marketplace to buy the plants that they want. There are certain risks associated with that because you never can be sure that people always get what they're trying to get. You know, there are hazards associated with that kind of approach. If you're not sure, then you can enlist the services of a healer, a traditional healer or shaman of some kind. Now, as I say, this woman may be one of these herself. She may just be buying or replenishing her stocks of material with which she can then treat local patients. So you can do one of those two things. You can also go to another part of this city in Lomé. This is a different market. This is the fetish market. And Togo is where the original voodoo practices originated. They claim they only use white voodoo these days, which is just as well. That's all we saw anyway when we were looking at these places. This is actually one of these fetish marketplaces, and you can go there and you can purchase whatever kind of materials you want, and you can also seek the advice of the healers on site there. So for example, in this particular site, this gentleman who was the manager of this marketplace was showing us around and showing us different healers and their various wares. You see that in this particular instance, there's a lot of animal products. I personally am not the least bit interested in investigating animal products for obvious reasons, but there are lots of plant materials around here too. And if you're not sure what to do about your specific ailments, then you can go and seek advice from him. He will take you to one of the healers there in their little sort of clinic areas, and then you can go through the various treatment processes or get advice as to what you should be taking. The skulls, they're probably mostly monkey ape skulls, I would imagine. I didn't inquire too deeply into what they were. I didn't look at every one either. You can also, if you want to stay away from the fetish market, in the same city, same country, you can go to the local traditional pharmacy. And this is one such place here, where everything is derived from plant materials. And this is a picture here showing some of my colleagues from the university in Lomé there. These people here are either pharmacists or chemists or microbiologists. Here's the white colonial scientist who's there to sort of make sure things are done properly. And as you have to do in these projects, of course. And so the next slide there will show the inside of this place. And there's the pharmacist himself with his some of his vast array of herbal products in neatly labeled bottles and things. Whatever kind of symptom or problem you have, he has a remedy, or I shouldn't say a remedy, he has a treatment for it. And you just have to read the names on the bottles with his advice, and he'll sell you some of this material. Although that's not clear in this slide here, but if you look at some other neighboring countries where they have similar traditions, you often run into pharmacies like this, which are designed especially for people who can't necessarily read or write. And those usually take the form of large placards or boards with very graphic representations of symptoms, you know, pictures of people with diarrhea and bloody urine and that sort of thing. And unfortunately, I was never allowed to take a picture of one of those things. But it's really fascinating to look at these things. And I suppose what you do is you go outside the pharmacy with a pharmacist and you point to one of the diagrams and say, this is what I have, what can you do about it, you know? So that's an alternative way of treatment. So there's a whole variety then of ways of effecting medicinal plant treatments. In different countries, different tribal groups have their own particular ways of doing these things, and they also have their own specific set group of plants and so forth which they will use. This has all been derived from traditional usage and application of these things over hundreds and hundreds of years, sometimes thousands of years, as in the case of Chinese traditional medicine or Ayurvedic medicine in India, for example. Many centuries of traditional use of these materials. Now, before I get into the real sort of meat of the presentation here, I must comment on a few terms, just to make sure that we all understand exactly what I'm talking about here. The top line there just indicates the fact that there are some interchangeable terms here. Medicinal plants, herbal medicines, phytomedicines, they all mean the same thing, essentially. I sometimes use this term, I sometimes use that one. Phyto, anything to do with phyto just means plant. Okay, so the actual chemicals that you derive from these phytomedicines are called phytochemicals. The people who investigate these things are phytochemists, for example, and these are thought to be, in many cases, the so-called active ingredients of the medicinal plants. There is a continuing argument or controversy as to whether one should be looking for specific phytochemicals as opposed to just using the crude extracts. And I'll return to this point one or two more times later during the presentation, because there are indications that you may not be able to explain the full efficacy of these things just in terms of individual chemicals. In other words, the potency of the crude extract sometimes turns out to be much greater than the sum of the individual chemicals that you isolate from them. And that's a very interesting consideration which demands scientific exploration and much more research. Another point that I want to briefly mention here, this concept of antiviral. When we talk about antiviral, are we really talking about elimination of viruses or just control? I sort of briefly mentioned this already, and my opinion on this, in view of having studied viruses for many, many decades, is that you're not really going to eliminate viruses. I think we have to put up with them. So the important thing is to find ways of controlling them, and in particular of augmenting our host defenses against viruses. Another point which I must mention too, because this has led to a lot of misconceptions, especially in the media in recent years, the question of whether you're going to cure somebody or treat somebody. I have been told repeatedly by African scientists that in many of the African languages they do not have a word which means cure. When they talk about giving these medicines to their patients, they're really talking about treating them. They're not talking about curing them. The concept of cure is a Western concept. And this has led to a lot of confusion in the media and so forth when you hear these claims by people saying that such and such a traditional healer in an African country has a cure for AIDS and so forth. There seem to be a lot of those these days, as cures for AIDS, because these people don't really have cures for AIDS, they have treatments. And that means something totally different, of course. But that does lead to confusion, because this leads to a lot of misconceptions in the newspapers, and among scientists too, I should say. So, what are my objectives, or the objectives of my sort of collaborative group? And I should mention at this point, before I forget, that this is largely collaborative work, because all of the work which I describe is extremely multidisciplinary, involving collaborators from many different disciplines in many different parts of the world. It's impossible to do this kind of research by yourself. You have to have money, of course, and you have to have lots of collaboration. And my principal collaborator over the last 10 years or so and at present is Professor Neil Towers in the Department of Botany here at UBC. He's in the audience here listening tonight. And the work I describe would not have been possible without his considerable assistance and advice. So I must mention that at this time. I will probably mention his name occasionally throughout the rest of the presentation in various contexts. These are the questions which I have set for myself and which I want to see answered, because it reflects my own personal interest as an academic scientist. I should also point out in this context that I'm not personally interested in patenting anything. I'm not interested in discovering, being part of a drug discovery program. My role in this is as an old-fashioned academic researcher. I do this work because I'm interested in doing it and I find it fun. I'm not interested in making money out of it. But I am interested in helping the scientists in the developing countries from establishing their own analytical laboratory setups, because I'd rather they do their own analyses rather than have people in the West make a lot of money by exploiting their resources. Now then, to get back to the point at hand there, so the first question then, do they contain antiviral activities? The results of our studies over the last 10 years have indicated very clearly, yes, frequently. Many, many medicinal plants from different parts of the world can be shown to have antiviral activities by our standard laboratory tests. There's no lack of materials there. So what we would like to do in all of these cases when we find these materials is, of course, to study the mechanism of action and to isolate and identify the active compounds. And this is the field of phytochemistry, and this is particularly where my colleague Neil Towers has to come into play. He's the phytochemist in our group and the expert in that field. Question number two, can the antiviral activity that we find explain the benefits of the medicinal plant extract? In other words, if you have all these antiviral activities, is that sufficient grounds for saying, well, that's how the thing works? I'm not personally satisfied that this has yet been demonstrated, but we'd like to think so. In other words, if you have an extract which works against herpes simplex virus in our standard laboratory tests, and you find that the people that use this extract use it for skin infections of various kinds, then it's the natural conclusion to draw, well, maybe that antiviral compound which we've isolated is responsible for the activity, the potency of the extract. But it's never actually been demonstrated yet, and there are some reasons for hesitating about that. It's not as simple as that. And of course, question number three, which follows from that, are there other ingredients there which add to the presence of the antiviral and the antibiotic materials so as to make the extract as potent as it turns out to be? And I will, towards the end of the presentation, I'll be giving you more sort of hints as to where research is leading to the indication that that is in fact the case. And this is the only slide I will show that says anything about the individual viruses. I just want to show for people who are interested what our standard test viruses are in the laboratory. We use these particular viruses because over the years I have devised, what happened to that one? Oops. Be patient. I'll get to it in a moment. Right. Okay, good. Having two things in different hands is sometimes a bit confusing. So these are the viruses that we use in our standard tests. Herpes viruses, we all know what they are. Polio virus. Synbis virus is a mosquito-transmitted virus. So it's a good model for certain kinds of virus infections. And influenza, of course. These are all viruses that can be handled safely and easily in our laboratories with our biosafety cabinets and so forth. They're easy to work with, and they're easy to run antiviral test protocols with. And they have the advantage in this combination with this different compositions of DNA, presence and absence of a membrane and so forth. This sometimes gives us clues as to how our... Okay? I bet that's never happened before. A little higher. Is that okay? Good. Sorry about that. That's why I'm a biologist. I hate handling things that require mechanical sort of flexibility. Yeah. So as I was saying then, the reason we're using these viruses is because you have this facility then for different kinds of molecular targets in the different viruses, sometimes if we have selectivity in the antiviral activities, then this can give us a pretty good clue as to what kind of compound we might be looking at in the extracts. Now to start with the specific examples, what I will begin with is a summary of a recent study carried out by one of our graduate students, Robin Taylor, who got her PhD in the Department of Botany here. And she did her studies on a group of medicinal plants from Nepal. What she did when she started out here, she made two trekking expeditions to Nepal in association with local botanists, particularly Professor Manandar. Is this working okay still? Is that okay? That could be construed one of two ways. Maybe I'll just hold it. Right. Okay. So Robin Taylor did her work then on Nepalese medicinal plants. What she did was she made two expeditions to different parts of Nepal, and in association with the local botanist and the university professor Manandar, she was able to collect on each occasion about 30 medicinal plants. She then prepared them or processed them in the field there. This was just to illustrate. Nepal, of course, remind you, has a very large variation in different kinds of landscape, scenery, and vegetation, and so forth. Plants vary considerably in different parts of the country because of the tremendous altitude variations, obviously. And local tribal groups have learned to adapt to use their own particular accessible kinds of plants. And what that means is that certain tribes in certain parts of the country use different species of plants from other parts of the country which are at different altitudes. So here's a photograph. These are Robin Taylor's photographs, actually. And here's a picture of some of the plants that she's drying out there as a prelude to packing them and bringing them back to Vancouver. And as a result of all her antiviral assays, she also did antibiotic assays and a number of other bioassays too, she was able to feed this information back to the her Nepali colleagues, and they started to incorporate some of this information in local booklets of information which they handed out to local community and health officers and so forth. So this is just an example of one of these local information booklets which are readily available for the local community people there, just explaining on both sides here, I guess. There we go again. Just explaining on the on both sides in Nepali script or in English script just what you actually do with these different plant materials. You'll notice if you look on the right-hand side there, a lot of these things there are used for skin and other infectious diseases. That's quite common. And Robin was able to get some of her information incorporated into that. Now, what she was able to do after this was she took the most potent extract from amongst all the ones that had antiviral activity. This one here, Carissa carandus, which is a bushy, sort of shrubby plant that grows in Nepal. It's the concentrations here indicate the sort of minimum concentrations that inactivate all of our virus in our test protocol system. It doesn't really matter too much exactly what the parameters are. But the point is, the lower the number, the lower the concentration, the more potent the material is. That's essentially what it means. And this is a very good crude extract. So what she decided to do was to purify the active ingredients from this material. She went through standard phytochemical purification procedures, some column fractionation procedures, vacuum liquid chromatography, high-performance liquid chromatography, and at each stage she would then take the fractions and test them for antiviral activity so she could figure out where the antiviral material was going, which fractions had the antiviral activity. And in the end, she figured out, she finished up with one purified peak of material, which she was then able to do her extensive chemical analysis of. And this involves a variety of spectroscopic, NMR, and mass spectroscopic procedures, which I'm not qualified to discuss in any detail. But as a result of that, she came up with a more or less definitive chemical structure for the active compound. It turned out to be a bit disappointing in the end because the material was a kind of a trimethoxycinnamic acid, which is not of interest to many chemists. You know, natural products chemists are always looking for some exotic structures. This one turned out to be fairly ordinary. And interestingly enough, too, the final product was not as active as she expected it to be on the basis of the original crude material. And here is an illustration of something which, when purified, doesn't turn out to be as good as you thought it was going to, indicating that either there was something else in the original extract which didn't come through, or there are multiple antiviral compounds in that extract, or that the chemical has been modified during its purification. But all of this leads one to suspect in a case like this that very often the crude extract might turn out to be more useful than the purified active compound. There are exceptions to this, though. And the next slide illustrates my second example. This is something much closer to home. St. John's wort, which will be familiar to some of you, I'm sure, Hypericum perforatum. It grows in temperate parts of the world, in Europe and in North America. Apparently, it grows in the university endowment lands here. And at least it does when at times when Neil Towers is not on one of his field expeditions. But under normal circumstances, it grows profusely in many different temperate parts of the world. And it's also found in northern parts of India. It's part of the Ayurvedic system. And it's present in the pharmacopoeia of many European countries. People in Germany, France, and Scandinavian countries have been using this material for centuries. And in fact, I was told a while ago by one of my Swedish science colleagues that when winter approaches in Sweden, they often take the flowers of this plant and soak them in schnapps, and then they drink the schnapps afterwards. And he said they feel much better after that. Yeah. So there's clear evidence that the Hypericum is obviously doing something useful, right? I'm not quite sure if control experiments were done in that case, but anyway, yeah. So on the Hypericum here, the little black granules there are the sort of storage granules, that were, for this compound, the hypericin, the active ingredient, which is a blood red, almost purple colored pigment. This is the active ingredient. And there's another interesting little story about this too. Many years ago, Neil Towers was writing a series of reviews on plant compounds with biological activity. And he suggested to me that I test this for antiviral activity. And I looked at the structure of this thing, the chemical structure, and I thought, well, that doesn't really look much like an antiviral compound. So I put it to one side for a few years. And we got scooped, because in the late 80s, a group in the United States came out with some key observations on this compound, showing that if you give one single injection of this compound into a whole bunch of mice before or after a retrovirus infection, it could cure them of the virus disease. All you needed was one single dose of 50 micrograms or less in a mouse. And so there have been ongoing investigations on the antiviral activity of this material. It's a very potent antiviral compound. And we actually have done considerable investigations on this ourselves. And we also had to show to the other investigators that this compound is an example of a class of plant materials which we call photosensitizers. That is to say that the activity of the compound requires light. In the case of hypericin, it's just ordinary sunlight is adequate. These kind of materials are generally not very active in the absence of light. If you keep them in dark, they don't do anything. But as soon as you shine light on them, or you have them present in a person or an animal who is being exposed to sunlight, then these things become active. And they have tremendous ranges of biological activities. I'll return to this compound in a little while because it has some very interesting activities. I'll go very quickly through the next three slides, which have chemical structures on them, because I just want to illustrate an extension of this study. Here I go again. These two compounds here, hypocrelins, are from Chinese medicinal fungal preparations. They go by the name of Hypocrella species. They have been used in Chinese traditional medicine for many, many years to treat a variety of infectious diseases. They're also anti-cancer agents as well. And the active ingredients are these compounds here, which chemically look somewhat similar to the hypericin. And indeed, they do have good antiviral activity, as does this other fungal compound here. These are very good antiviral compounds. But in contrast to that, another range of fungal compounds here, which look very similar chemically, are not such good antiviral compounds. They tend to be relatively weak. And just by way of comparison, here's another group of fungal and synthetic compounds of the same kind chemically, which have absolutely no antiviral activity whatsoever. And that illustrates another thing that we have to deal with when we're trying to analyze these materials, is that very often you find that slight changes in chemical structure lead to complete negation of antiviral activity. In other words, the biological activity of these compounds requires a very specific chemical configuration or structure, very highly dependent on the chemical structure. Now, to a phytochemist, that's no surprise, but to biologists, that's sometimes quite astonishing when they find these sudden changes in activity. I'll go now on to my third example here, and this is a different situation again. This is an older situation. Neil Towers will recognize this slide, although I got it from one of his graduate students. This is Mexico, specifically the Baja Peninsula in springtime, and you'll notice the profusion of these yellow-colored flowers there. These are medicinal plants used in Mexico, again, to treat a variety of infectious diseases and other kinds of complaints. This is the actual plant itself. The flower is a member of the daisy family, the Asteraceae. And it looks fairly inconspicuous, and and looks like a typical member of the daisy family. And the next slide here shows the name of this particular plant and the very potent active, biologically active compounds that you find in these plants. Different parts of the plant contain different derivatives of these compounds we call thiophenes. And they're called thiophenes because of the presence of these sulfur atoms in each one of these rings. They can either be one, two, or three of these thiophene rings in one of these chemicals. And the ones with three rings are particularly active. In fact, they are the most active antiviral compounds that we have ever analyzed. Extremely potent. They also require light, but in this case, they require light of a slightly different kind. It's a long-wave ultraviolet light, the kind that you find in sunlight. So sunlight is a very good way of stimulating the biological activity of these materials. And so if you were taking one of these plants medicinally, an extract of them, then you get the maximum beneficial effect by exposing yourself to sunlight. And that goes along with some of the traditional usage of many of these plants, because in different parts of the world, not so much in Vancouver, of course, but in different parts of the world where they have sunshine, then it's quite commonly found that that light is used as an integral part of the treatment. And this explains why, because the active compounds are probably photosensitizers. This is the actual chemical compound itself with the greatest activity, so-called alpha-tothionyl, from that plant. It's found in a number of other members of the Asteraceae family as well. And what I've done here, at the far end of the right-hand end of the structure, I've put this R, which indicates that we have actually spent a considerable amount of time trying to improve the antiviral activity of this by adding other chemical groups to it. In association with our phytochemistry colleagues at the University of Ottawa, Thor Arneson and Robin Miles, who's now at Brandon University of Manitoba, we've done a lot of work on synthetic derivatives of this compound, but you'll be pleased to know, I think, that we have never been able to improve upon the activity of the prototype natural plant compound. Just like the hypericin, the chemical derivatives do not seem to improve the activity. Very often they make it less efficient. So that's an interesting sort of take-home message as well. And just to finish off this part of the presentation, I just want to summarize here some data from some of our other recent collaborative efforts with people in different parts of the world, just to indicate the incredible frequency of finding antiviral compounds. If you just look very quickly through these columns of data here, these are the number of different species or number of extracts tested, and look at the number with antiviral activities. In many cases, they're over 50%. So antiviral activities are very frequently encountered in these materials. And also, quite often, they turn out to be these photosensitizers and the materials requiring light. And just by way of interest, I put on these other data at the end here. We started looking at seaweed extracts in recent years, too, because seaweeds obviously are a renewable resource. It turns out that they're quite rich in antiviral compounds, too. Although I don't want to say anything more about those at this time, because as far as I know, nobody uses seaweeds as medicinal plants. Although if anybody knows of such things, I'd be happy to learn about it. You may wonder at this stage, just as a brief diversion here, why plants seem to have such a high frequency of photosensitizers. And the general consensus among the experts is that, first of all, it's nothing to do with the antiviral activities. Plants don't have photosensitizers because they're antivirals. They have these materials which they've evolved over the centuries to defend themselves against insect pests. And this is what this slide illustrates here. There's a continuing evolution between herbivorous insects and the plants that they feed on. Plants are always trying to find ways of defending themselves. They can't get up and run away. I mean, we can swat at mosquitoes and we can run away from bees and wasps, but plants can't do anything. And if you have to sit there and have insects coming along chewing on your appendages, then you know, you really need some kind of other defense mechanism. And they then, over the years, have elaborated these photosensitizers, this plethora of chemicals, to discourage the insects from chewing at their leaves. And it just so happens, accidentally, that these materials often have very good antiviral and antimicrobial activities. I should point out, just before I forget, too, that again, in contrast to the synthetic drug approach, because remember I accented that point at the beginning there, these natural antiviral compounds frequently have very good antibiotic and antifungal activities as well. They're not just antivirals. A few of them might be, but many of them are not. They have a wide range of biological activities. And that, in my mind, makes them much more useful in terms of using them medicinally, especially if you don't know what it is that's causing your symptoms. And of course, if you do have a virus infection, then a frequent complication of serious virus infections is opportunistic bacteria and fungi, which can come in and cause more serious infections. So if you have natural materials, natural compounds, which have a wide range of biological activities, then you can take care of all these super-infecting organisms as well, not just the viruses. Now then, on to the last sort of theme, the last part of the presentation today. Just before you, in case you might run away with the idea that all I'm interested in are the direct antiviral effects of these compounds, remember that the host, the person in this case, isn't just standing around passively suffering from virus infections. We have host defenses, which are designed to control viruses and bacteria. And the most effective controls during the initial encounter between a virus, for example, and the body is this set of responses which we're just beginning to learn more about in recent years. There's a series of cells, the so-called natural killer cells, macrophages and polymorphs, which are there to counteract and dispose of virus-infected cells as soon as they recognize them. The recognition is initiated by these so-called pro-inflammatory cytokines and chemokines, which are essentially a bunch of proteins in the body, which are among which their most important functions are to turn on these other cell types and to interrelate and come up with part of a network of responses against these virus infections. So by either direct or indirect means, all of these things come up and are designed to counteract the proliferation of the virus, and is being awarded to three investigators who in the 70s and 80s did all the pioneering work on this molecule, nitric oxide, which turns out to be an extremely important physiological material in the body. It serves a lot of different kinds of functions. But recently, in recent years, it has been discovered that that material is also a very effective antiviral compound, as well as an antibacterial compound. And so if you have a system, or if you have herbal medicines, for example, which can turn on the production of nitric oxide in the local region of a virus infection, then that could be very beneficial. And as I'll indicate shortly, that's exactly what the evidence indicates. In addition to the early responses here, there's also these the classical immune system, which eventually gets turned on. But during a normal encounter with a virus, especially the primary encounter with a virus, these things are a late response. This is the system which is turned on early in order to counteract virus infection. Antibodies are useful in counteracting subsequent virus infections. But the very first time we encounter a virus, it's those early responses that are the important ones. So in order to get back into this context again, here's this St. John's wort, this hypericin, the hypericum plant with the hypericin itself. And the reason I'm bringing this back into focus again is because recent information garnered over the last 2 years or so has indicated that hypericin has a tremendous range of biological activities, including many things which are highly relevant to these host defenses. So, for example, hypericin can kill viruses, it can stop virus replication. It interferes, or it can inhibit certain protein kinases, especially protein kinase C. Protein kinases are enzymes in the body that serve to regulate a lot of gene expression and are involved in a variety of different pathways inside the cell in which genes are turned on and off. And that includes many of the cytokines and so forth. And so there is an obvious relevance in that case. And these last three responses here are part of an anti-inflammatory response that the body offers. And these are also inhibited by hypericin. And again, of particular importance too, I think, stimulation of nitric oxide. It's been shown in model cell culture systems and in animals that hypericin can stimulate the production of nitric oxide. So in other words, what I'm saying here is that just this one compound, hypericin, can do all of these things, some of which are clearly beneficial to an antiviral response. So in addition to attacking the virus directly, it also has the capability of turning on antiviral defenses. So if just one phytochemical can do that, then suppose there are other phytochemicals in a crude extract which can also do similar kinds of things which may augment those things, then perhaps we're onto the road to helping to explain how some of these medicinal plant materials can work. At least that's what I would like to think. The challenge, of course, is to come up with simple, useful sort of bioassay procedures to try and work out all the detailed mechanisms here and to see whether this explains why sometimes the crude extracts are more potent than individual phytochemicals. Because there you have several different phytochemicals working together, then maybe they augment the activity of each other. I'm sure many of you are aware that it is common practice in Chinese traditional medicine, for example, not just to treat a person with a single crude extract, but sometimes to have as many as 10 different plants all ground together in a single preparation. And apparently the efficacy of these things is dependent on having the right proportion of, say, the 10 different plant materials. If you take one out, it reduces the efficacy. And so this has been learned over centuries of traditional applications. So it's up to the scientific community to try and put the sort of scientific explanations behind this to explain why this is so. And so I have a couple of message slides to finish up with here. This is a fairly obvious one. Why spend our time looking for these magic bullets when there's so much stuff out there which has been shown by centuries of traditional usage to work? The challenge to us in the scientific community is to try and explain why it works and to authenticate it all, to validate it all. However, time is running out, not just in my presentation, but also in the world of natural resources, because that self-explanatory slide indicates, it's a slide I borrowed from Neil Towers here, and these materials are disappearing. And we have to work as fast as we can to try and analyze these situations, explain them, and before the resources run out. Thank you very much.
Dr. Hudson is going to take questions, and I'm going to ask him to please repeat the question before he answers it, if he hears it clearly. Okay. Do you want to take that?
Sure. Autumn crocus, yes. I certainly can't explain why, but I... the question was, why is autumn crocus, which is poisonous to cattle, right? And yet is it actually used or is beneficial in gout? There's many possible explanations for that, but I suspect it may be partly a dose-related situation. In other words, the... very often with any kind of chemical, of course, it's true of drugs or natural products, you can come up with a beneficial dose of something, but if you exceed that dose by too much, it could turn out to be toxic. know, this has been shown with a number of plant materials too. For example, the St. John's wort. In fact, St. John's wort can be lethal to cattle if they graze and consume too much of the hypericum plant in the presence of very strong sunlight. And yet, you know, you can use the stuff safely in humans. So it might be a question of dosage, a relative concentration effect, or it might be a question in that case of different animals being able to shunt the material through different pathways. In other words, there may be a question of pharmacology, pharmacokinetics, and so forth, you know. That's all I can offer as a possible explanation for that kind of phenomenon. But it's not unusual. Sorry? Okay, I'll use the business then. I'll use the microphone here then, yes. Yes?
Have you had occasion to study a herbal product called mantol, M-A-T-O-L?
I've heard of it.
And have you studied it? And so what conclusions?
No, I haven't studied it. Understandably, there's a limit to how many materials I can study. I would like to study all of these materials, but in order to do that, we'd have to have enormous funding and big staff to do all this kind of work. So we have to pick materials, yeah.
That was a material called mattol for those people at the back who didn't hear. Dr. Hudson hasn't studied it.
Yes.
I'd like to ask you, looking ahead for 10 years, following through the sorts of research you're doing, what difference will this make in the teaching of people entering the medical profession?
What difference in 10 years' time, what difference will this make to the teaching of medical students? Well, I would like to think it would have a significant effect in the sense that medical students would get a chance to receive teaching and be taught about the value of medicinal plants. In that connection, I think I can draw an analogy maybe with acupuncture. You know, say 15 or 20 years ago in Vancouver, acupuncture was very much frowned upon. Now, as I understand, I believe the medical students actually receive teaching in acupuncture, or they have the opportunity to do that. It's respectable in Vancouver. And so I certainly hope that in another 10 years or so that you may have a situation where medical students right here at UBC even may receive actual discussions, tutorials, and so forth on the possible uses and applications of medicinal plants. If they don't, then the public is certainly going to continue using them in increasing amounts.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You said two things separated by several minutes that fascinated me. One is that you were scooped because you didn't investigate the St. John's wort because it didn't look like an antiviral. And then a few minutes later you said how small a change it takes in a molecule to change its antiviral activity substantially. Is there a look?
Okay, somebody was sort of asking me why I, when I made this comment about the hypericin not looking like an antiviral, why did I make that discussion? And in view of the fact that later on I mentioned that the chemical structure only needs to change a little bit to drastically alter the antiviral activity or something, that was my own short-sightedness in that case. And what I was trying to do there was to use as an example of showing, of illustrating the fact that scientists must always keep an open mind on the subject.
Is there a look to an antiviral?
Is there a look to an antiviral? The lesson I learned from that is absolutely not. I mean, before that time, I was hoping there was. You know, I was going by the standard literature and the work that had been done on synthetic materials, because there was a situation a few years back where a lot of thousands and thousands of compounds, drugs, were being tested for antiviral activity, and they're all chemically the same. And so they're all having antiviral activity, but not particularly effective clinically. But everybody was looking at the same kind of structure, simply because somebody else has shown that something similar had worked, you know. And so the lesson that I learned from that was that you really have to keep an open mind, and everything is strictly empirical. You know, you can't look at a chemical and say, well, that looks as if it might be antiviral or not. That's the lesson I learned from that.
You don't even have a look. You can't tell me why any of this
works. Exactly, exactly, yeah.
Question over here.
Yes.
I noticed from your comment and illustration, my own observation is that the majority of these plants in a dry form, do you feel that lingering loss between the green plant and the dry form?
Possibly everybody heard that question, I think. Is there any difference between the dried form of the plant, which is often used, and the something closer to the original green state? That's an interesting question. I certainly can't give a satisfactory answer to that. All I can point out is that in traditional medicine, the materials that are used vary quite considerably in the mode of preparation. You know, some cases dried materials are used, sometimes they're extracted with hot water, sometimes they're treated in many different ways, and it's difficult to try and understand how the modern traditional practice of using one of these applications was actually derived, presumably by trial and error. But I really can't say in any particular case whether the original green plant, in the case of a leaf, for example, would be any better than a processed part of it. This needs to be studied, and to my knowledge, nobody's really made a comprehensive analysis of this kind of thing. But it's a very important consideration.
Just one minute at the back.
Yes, at the back. Yeah. I haven't been able to study them. I would like to. I do know that a Japanese group has found anti-herpes virus activity in spirulina, for example, although as far as I know, spirulina has not been advocated in these magazines as an anti-herpes thing. Maybe it should be. But yes, I say this goes back to the point I was making right at the very beginning. You see all kinds of claims made for these things, and they may be valid, but the point is we need a scientific explanation. I'm not satisfied by an untested statement like that. Yes? Yes, okay, that's an important point too. The question was, how do we test for the antiviral activity? We use a series of cell culture models with those particular viruses that I showed in one slide there. We just one virus at a time. We actually have the facility for growing the viruses in specific cell cultures, and what we're looking for basically is whether one of these extracts or a purified chemical can kill the virus in one of these cell culture models. It's an indication that there is antiviral activity. That doesn't necessarily mean, of course, that it explains what's happening in vivo. It doesn't necessarily mean that same material will work the same way in an animal or a human. And so, but of course, in the case of traditional medicines, the clinical work has already been done. It's been done over centuries. If you want to understand the real mechanism of action, then one will have to use appropriate animal models, you know, virus infections in mice, for example. But that gets to be expensive. But that's the only way to nail down that issue. Yes, Peter. Yeah. Well, what I would say is the next time you get a virus infection, you may not necessarily recognize it as a virus infection. You may just have a series of symptoms. What I would say is if you if you start feeling the onset of a runny nose, a cold, flu, that kind of thing, do what I do, reach for the echinacea. It works. I've no idea why. And as a matter of fact, a couple of years ago, I tested it in my antiviral protocol, and it didn't work. So I think what's happening is that it's a case of... There are some German investigators, actually, who spent a lot of time on this, and their indications are that echinacea works by stimulating one of these host defenses, host responses.
Can you
yeah.
repeat the first part of what you said?
The first part.
Some people, including myself, didn't hear you.
The reach for the echinacea? Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, E-C-H-I-N-E-C-A, Echinacea. E-C-H-I-N-E-C-E-A, Echinacea. It's present in all herbal food stores, herbal, your health food stores and herbal stores.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it may not work with everybody, though. I would make that qualification. There may be some individuals that it doesn't work with. Because one thing that I didn't get to mention is that we have to remember that each individual is different. And our detailed host responses and things are probably a little bit different because each one of us is biochemically unique. And you can't just assume that what works with one person will necessarily work with another person. Yes.
I wonder if there's an implication that antivirals need to be activated by light. Because if the viral is a whole plant capacity dependent on the fact that it can turn off for a number of hours in case.
I guess your question is involving the importance of light in the possible survival of these plants. And I'm not really sure how to answer that one, to be honest. I would say that the survival of those particular plants obviously depends upon their ability to come up with materials that can counteract these herbivorous insects. But I'm not quite, I don't know where to go from there in trying to answer that question. Yes.
Okay, there seems to be no way to control it. So when you're doing these tests, are you extracting active ingredients? And then how do you know if you went back the next year to get the same plant, it might be different?
This is a very important question which has been raised here. The question of the variation of these medicinal plants from one time to another, and in fact they vary quite considerably from one geographical region to another. See, all of this, this is actually something that I think tends to validate our belief that these things can be explained in terms of individual phytochemicals, because we know that the individual phytochemical composition does vary quite considerably. And there are at least two people in the audience here that can tell you far more about that than I can. But yes, I'm not surprised by your statement about the natural coloring materials, because you can go back to the same area for the same plants on two consecutive occasions and find, you know, different amounts of the same materials. You can also find the same plant species growing in slightly different regions, and the composition, the chemical composition, is not identical. In fact, there is evidence to indicate that some of the chemical composition varies to some extent even during the course of a day. You know, there are variations. So this is something that confounds the traditional healers, the shamans and so forth. This is something that they have to deal with, and is something that we as investigating scientists have to acknowledge and deal with too. Once we get the purified materials, then it's of no concern, because we can work with that on a consistent basis. But yeah, you're absolutely right, and that's a very important issue. And that also relates back to the previous question about when you buy these materials in health food stores and so forth, how do you know you're getting the same potency each time? Well, unless they have a good quality control procedure, which some companies do, by which they ensure standard amounts of a given compound, then you have no assurance that the quality of the material is the same in different batches for that reason, because there is variation.
We'll just take two more questions. There's one over here.
Yes. What was the first part of the question there? Okay, that's an interesting question. It was the non-medicinal plants. Do they turn out to be more susceptible to diseases? I have absolutely no idea. I would have to defer to a plant pathologist to educate me. I never really thought too much about that. But I would like to point out, though, that remember that the fact that we have plants which have antiviral activities doesn't necessarily mean the plants can make use of that against plant viruses, because plant viruses are not the same as human viruses. And so they may not be using these materials to counteract their own diseases. I think they're more there for the reason for the to counteract the insects. But it's an interesting question.
There's a question over here.
Yes. The question concerns the traditional Chinese medicine, which is, of course, has been in operation for, as you say, for in some cases thousands of years. Their traditional system is also slightly changing too over the years. It's not a static thing, of course. None of these systems are static. They're continuously being adapted. But yeah, they have these very long-standing traditions, and we have made one or two attempts to do some to look for antiviral materials, and some of these materials we have found them, but unfortunately, we would like to do more of these studies, but again, we're limited by what we can hope to accomplish. We're limited by funding primarily. There's only so many things that we can look at once, and the other thing too is that in the Chinese scientific system itself, there are a lot of facilities in Chinese universities for studying their own materials. They don't actually need our help anymore, but they have the traditional materials, of course, and they have the capacity to investigate their own materials. So I think partly for that reason, too, we've not spent too much time looking at their materials. They're quite capable of doing it by themselves.
I'm going to cut it off now and ask Dr. John Diggins to thank our speaker.
I'm not going to touch that speaker, ladies and gentlemen. I think I'll use the mic here. And like many of you, I feel more in touch with my viruses than I ever have in my life, listening to all the questions and discussion here tonight. But really, ladies and gentlemen, I have a very special privilege on your behalf, and that is to thank our speaker, Dr. Hudson, tonight. I liked his talk. I really enjoyed it. What I really liked about it was the very topic, the idea of this interrelationship between viruses and plant medicines, the nature of it. He used in one of his expressions, Mother Nature. And as he was telling us, the application of science to traditional treatments and medicines around the world is a very fascinating subject. I'm also very fascinated by Jim Hudson himself and how an individual working in a laboratory at the University of British Columbia can extend his research to Africa and Tibet and around the world. It's a magical story that binds up this evening and makes it very special. I like Jim's sense of humor and the ease of his presentation, but what I really liked about it, Jim, and I think I speak for everybody here tonight, is how he took a complex subject and made it very accessible and interesting for all of us. So please, ladies and gentlemen, please join in acknowledging Dr. If I could hold your attention for one more minute, I'd also like to acknowledge the Vancouver Institute itself and Peter and Pat and others who put on this series, this lecture tonight, and the series for the year. Ladies and gentlemen, please acknowledge the Vancouver Institute itself. Thank you for coming and have a safe journey home. Thank you very much.